from Minor Monuments to Platform 31. Playwright who values vulnerability in a writer, but not too much. And from St. Aloysius to Poetry Ireland Introductions. You're listening to Encore on Midlands 103. And indeed, Encore is Midlands 103's dedicated arts programme. We're with you every single Thursday night between 7 and 8 o'clock with the best of what is happening in, around and about culture in and the arts in Laois, Offaly and Westmeath. And as I say, every single Thursday night. How bad is that? I have great guests on the show for you this evening. Really looking forward a little bit later on to chatting to Ian Malini. Ian is from County Offaly and he is this year's recipient of the Platform 31 bursary from County Offaly, and we'll be talking about his work and particularly, I think, about a website that he is involved in. A website really doesn't do it justice. It's called fallowmedia.com and it really is a treasure trove of beautiful, beautiful things in a space that you don't necessarily expect to find on the internet. We'll be continuing the interview with Jimmy Curie. We were talking to him last week on the show, you might remember, the author of The Two Loves of Gabriel Foley. And he'll be chatting tonight about that play, about the popularity that it enjoys and the relationship that he has with Gabriel over the years. And finally, I'll be chatting tonight to Paul McCarrick. Paul is from Athlone and he is a poet and he has had an extraordinary couple of years. We'll be chatting to him about the successes that he has had, the profile that he has built up and what is next on his agenda. And that is all still to come on the Encore Arts Programme on Midlands 103. And don't forget, if you want to get in touch with the programme, encore@midlands103.com is the email address. And I'd absolutely love to hear from you. So do please get in touch, particularly as we are gearing up for the autumn season when things are getting very, very, very busy and plays are being chosen and musicals are being decided on. Let me know what's happening in the arts in your area. Somebody who has had enormous fame many years after she initially had fame is Kate Bush. And at this moment in time, I need to say a little hello to Owen Carter and to his big sister, Andy Carter. Owen used to sit in front of me in Irish when I was in school and he introduced me tape by tape by tape to Kate Bush, courtesy of his sister, Andy, and her collection of Kate Bush tapes. So I owe a lifelong dedication to Kate Bush, to the Carter family from Ballyfin. Many people are coming to Kate Bush only in recent times following Stranger Things. Kate Bush on Encore on Midlands 103. And that is the inimitable, the extraordinary, the much more than running up that hill, Kate Bush. Stay with us on Encore because after the break, we'll be discussing Platform 31 with Ian Malini from County Offaly. Stay with us. Still to come on Encore this evening, we bring you the second part of the interview we started last week with playwright Jimmy Curie, and we'll also be talking to poet Paul McCarrick. That's all still to come on the programme. Successful in his own right and in his own field is writer and radio producer Ian Malini, whose book of essays, Minor Monuments, was published by Tramp Press in 2019. And you might also have read him in the Irish Times. This year, he was chosen as Offaly's Platform 31 recipient. This is, remember, the programme that supports artists and creatives who are established in their careers. Ian, we'll talk about Platform 31 in a moment, but maybe you tell me first about an absolute gem that I've only recently discovered, which is fallowmedia.com.
So I guess it came from a little bit of frustration with digital publishing, say, kind of in the early part of the last decade, sort of. So it was founded in 2015. In the years before that, blogging was a very big thing, and a lot of literary publications, I suppose, were sort of starting in that space. But I felt they were quite limited by their knowledge or lack thereof of the actual tools of digital publishing. And around that time, I started to get into web design and picking up bits and pieces like that. And I just found it a very exciting space. And I thought we could do a bit more. We could take really excellent writing and put it with design elements that were as, or at least attempting to be, as creative and interesting as the writing. And it's the collision of those two things, I suppose, which has kept the site going for the last 6 or 7 years.
Well, I know that you build websites for arts organisations, so that's, I suppose, a kind of a day job kind of a thing. But there is something much more going on in Fallow Media, isn't there, in terms of the kind of voices that are there. And even the beautiful layout, it's extraordinary. It's really attractive.
Thanks. Yeah, it's a place where, I guess, it's the playground, you know, really, for me anyway, because I do design all the pieces that are on there, and I'm working with writers or musicians or artists or whatever, whoever it is that I'm working with on a particular piece. But I'm trying to come up with a presentation for that work, which I feel enhances it and takes advantage of what is possible. And sometimes that's maybe, obviously, it comes with a sort of workload and an experimental sort of outlook, which you can't really get away with in a more standard publication. But at the same time, I think it does serve. And I think over the last few years, I've seen it have a little bit of an influence anyway on what people, writers in particular, are, how they see their work existing online. And I think that's, you know, that's the best compliment that I can think of for the work that's being done there.
It sounds like those are really interesting creative conversations between two people who are creating a space for something to exist and the thing that's going to exist in it, as opposed to simply hosting a piece of work.
Yeah, that's kind of, I mean, anyone who's published on it will know it takes a long time. it both in terms of the editorial process, which can be long and fairly stringent. Certainly it was in the early days anyway. And then the actual design process, which, you know, it just takes time to figure out what is the best way to do this. And, you know, try not to repeat yourself and try always to find new ways and more appropriate ways of getting that work out there. And I think people are, because we have that, you know, that history of 6 or 7 years of publishing, the people that we're working with are aware of what can be done, more so than they were at the start, and they have their own opinions and their own thoughts about how that can work. And yeah, they're very fruitful conversations for sure.
Have they come to understand how time consuming and how involved creating something like this is? Very often people think, you know, and I know you do radio production as well, radio documentaries and podcasts and things, and people who consume these media assume that things are very simple and straightforward. You turn up with a microphone, you record, and then it's done. What you're doing is very much more complex. Do you think there's an understanding there of the level of involvement and engagement that's required on your behalf to create something like that?
It probably depends on the piece. I think sometimes someone will see something and they'll think, wow, that's very complex, or that must have taken a long time. And often that isn't, you know, something that did take a long time, or the things that seem simple might actually have taken longer. But I think there is a growing understanding maybe of the opportunities there, and gradually, I guess, an understanding of what is involved in taking those opportunities or making the most of them. And that definitely is time and investment and rethinking what a piece can be, or how it can reach an audience.
Time, investment and rethinking are all connected with the Platform 31 award that you've received from Offaly County Council. What are you going to do with that time and space?
The main thing for me, I suppose, is time to write. I mean, it's the hardest time to find these days. There's a lot of pressure from just different work that I'm doing. So any time that I can find to get away from all that and stare at a blank page for a little while and work on pieces, I think is very, very valuable to me. And the Platform 31 is obviously a massive bonus, you know, unexpected opportunity really for me to just hopefully clear a bit of time and give the next book some well overdue attention.
Last week on the programme we were talking to Kate Heffernan, who has won the award in Laois, and she was talking about how since she's moved home she's spending a lot of time in the garden, and that physical activity gives her a little bit of headspace to work on her writing. But as somebody who is creating and writing as part of his work all the time, it must be really challenging to separate the reviewer part of your brain from the writer part of your brain, from the documentary part of your brain. I imagine that's a very busy head to be in creatively.
It definitely is very busy up there at the minute, yeah. I think for me, I've learned a little bit, I suppose, about the ways that I work and what suits me. And realistically, that is total separation. When it comes to writing, I kind of need to put everything else aside in a very definitive way, whether that's for a couple of days or a week or 2 weeks or whatever it is, however long I can sort of justify. It sounds a little bit precious, but it is the only way that work really gets done. And it does tend to be the case that a lot of work gets done in a short space of time if I can sort of park everything else and go off by myself and have those few days or that week and just put the head down, you know.
Minor Monuments was published in 2019. Is what you're working on now in that space that you have, is it similar or in a different vein?
Formally, I suppose it's not too different in that it is still, you know, creative nonfiction. Subject matter is, I suppose, quite different. It's a little bit early to say exactly what it's going to be, but it's definitely a little bit less personal. I haven't had enough time, I guess, since my monuments came out to have any more personal stories come along. So it's a bit more, maybe just a bit more about the world rather than my own experiences. But it's coming along, and hopefully by the end of the year we'll have a fairly strong shape on it.
2009 was, you know, at that stage the essay had really come back into vogue, hadn't it, as an art form. Who are you reading? Who inspires you as essay writers?
Essay writers. I continue to read Joan Didion and read Joan Didion a lot. She's someone who, I guess when she passed away, started this. I'd never stopped reading her, but I think maybe in months after that, it really kind of, I realized maybe just how big an influence she is and has been. But with Minor Monuments, I think looking back on it, the influence of John Berger just seems strong, extremely strong to me, perhaps too strong in places. But definitely those two, I think, have been just real touchstones for me over the last 5 or 10 years, I suppose.
And I should ask you finally, I think you're based in Dublin now, I think, are you?
I am currently, yeah.
Yeah, and how much then finally does Offaly figure in your sense of yourself or your creative well that you draw from?
It's pretty huge, to be honest. I mean, I think I've realised, I suppose, as I've gotten a little bit older, how central it is to who I am and how I see the world. That's just the influence of my family. I'm very lucky to be very close with my family, I think, and still very strongly connected to the place where I grew up. And I do hope at some point to be able to live there again. But that's something that maybe in the next few years will pan out. But I think just the sense of security and connectedness is just so important. In terms of giving you an identity in the world and a way of looking at the world. And then the peace of mind, I suppose, that I feel when I'm there, just the quietness and the calm of being there, the openness of the area where we're from. And it clears the mind out. I guess like what Kate was saying about the gardening, you know, to go for a walk in the bog is often the best way to chew something over and come back clearer at the end of it.
Ian Mullaney, thank you so much for talking to us on Encore this evening.
Thank you very much, Claire.
And if you'd like to find out a little bit more about what Ian is doing, I cannot recommend enough that you have a look at that website, fallowmedia.com. It is extraordinary. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be talking to Jimmy Keary, playwright. Stay with us on Encore on Midlands 103. A little bit later on in the programme tonight, I'll be talking to Athlone poet Paul McCarrick, and he'll be reading for us as well. So very much looking forward to that this evening. Last week, you might remember that we began in conversation with playwright Jimmy Keary, and Jimmy had been involved in attending not just the final night of the performance of his play For Better or For Worse in Mount Mellick. He had also been there for the first read through of the play, and he had gone to a dress rehearsal. And he talked to us about how much he really enjoys being part of an audience and being among people, as the work of a playwright is by its nature quite solitary. When we finished the conversation last week, we were talking a bit about Gabriel Foley, of the his first full and well-known play, I suppose, The Two Loves of Gabriel Foley. And we were chatting about the role that Gabriel plays in his life and how Jimmy says he needed just to get a little bit more out of that character and out of his possibilities.
It's an unusual in the sense, like, I mean, if I knew why it was so successful, I'd be writing all my plays like that. But casts seem to enjoy performing it and rehearsing it as much as audiences seem to enjoy watching it. And that's why I revisited it again in For Better or For Worse, the play which Mount Mellick did. I thought there was further potential in the characters. Like in The Two Loves of Gabriel Foley, it's really about the courtship of Gabriel and Chrissy. But in For Better or For Worse, they've been married maybe 3 or 4 months and things aren't going well. But you wouldn't have needed to have seen the first play for the second play to work for you.
Because it's one of those universal stories, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah. And, you know, loneliness and isolation and that. I mean, in this case, I've written The Two Loves of Gabriel Foley and For Better or For Worse like as comedies. But you could equally write a serious play about the same subject. You know, the elements are the same. It's just how you treat it.
And you're writing The Perfect Match is the one you're working on at the moment. Is that the next stage in Gabriel's story, or have you moved to a different direction altogether?
No, that's completely different. No, I think I've finished with Gabriel now. I mean, I've gone to that well twice, and unless Chrissy suddenly becomes pregnant, I don't see anywhere to go with it. But I'm not saying never, you know, never ever. But The Perfect Match is about another young couple living in the country, Anthony and Claire, who have to keep their romance a secret after their mothers have a big row. So that's and other adversities that they have to overcome on the journey.
Do you find yourself giggling away as you're writing?
Yeah, sometimes. Well, especially when I read it back aloud, which I have to do. And I mean, every time you read it aloud, you make changes, because with comedy, there's kind of a rhythm. And if you have too many words in a sentence, you know, it kills the comedy because you're stumbling over words, or if you have a lot of commas, or you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you kind of have to have it short and snappy. But I would find myself laughing occasionally and kind of wondering, well, where did that line come out of? Because when you're writing a play, you're kind of every character in the play. And so it's kind of like, I would say, sometimes playing table tennis with yourself, because you're hitting out a line and then you're giving the reply. And if you're really in tune with the characters, sometimes you've almost typed out the line before you've thought about it. Do you know what I mean? You're so in tune with your characters.
Yeah. And what do you watch? What do you read? What feeds the well? What fills the well for you?
Well, it's mostly out and about and meeting people and people watching and just my life to date. I mean, I've 64 years to draw on now. So you've lots of experiences, even going back like to when I was a child and people I met and people I knew. And I mightn't use any of them in this play, but in the next play, or you know, you draw on incidents. I mean, there was an incident locally where I think some man got a trucker to pretend he was a faith healer, and he gave these two elderly ladies who were suffering from arthritis, I think he gave them foot massages, even though he wasn't a faith healer at all. And that's, I use that story in For Better For Worse. There's actually a scene where Liam Gavigan gives Aunt Lucy a foot massage and pretends to be a seventh son of a seventh son. And that's where, like a lot of elements scattered through the players are actually from real life.
And will the good people of Rathowen be peppering, as my own mother would say, when the perfect match comes out and they wonder, will they be in it?
Well, the thing is, anyone who's ever crossed my path in my life should be worried, because you draw from, I suppose, every interaction you have has an effect on you or leaves a lasting impression on you. And so there's little incidents. And I find that using incidents from real life kind of grounds the player for me, grounds it in reality, and so helps me write about it with more authority. And I'm told I write very strong women's parts.
Which is true.
And that the men kind of seem to be tend to be weaker. So, like, I mean, in my own case, I would suffer, and I mean, I'm freely admitting this, I would suffer from a lack of self-confidence. So that tends to be reflected in my plays, or how my male characters are portrayed. They're usually kind of a bit ineffectual and a bit sort of... And the women are strong. The women are strong because my father died when I was 7, so my mother reared me on her own. And, you know, the difficult times, we had very little money, and she was a hard worker and that, and got me through secondary school and then got me to university and that. And, you know, I owe her everything. So I suppose it's the influences like that and influences of people you see that women, that, you know, define how you write. And, well, it defines, like, how you live your life and such.
And have you ever been tempted to write a very exciting, dramatic, heroic, incredibly confident male character to try on that persona if you feel it's so different to your own?
Well, sometimes in a few of the plays, the worm turns in the sense that the man stands up for himself, either with a boss or with some other person in his life, maybe who's making his life difficult, and you sort of kind of imagine yourself in that situation, that you would say the right thing and have the right comeback and have the right, but it doesn't always happen that way. What usually happens in my case, like, is if somebody says something to me that offends me or whatever, I tend to go away and think about it rather than come back with a strong comeback, as I suppose a lot of people do who lack kind of self-confidence. And like, one of the reasons I got into writing in the first place was, at school, I was hopeless at sport. And, like, when you're hopeless at sport, especially back then in the 60s when things wouldn't have been enlightened, you're made feel that you're hopeless.
Yeah.
So then the teacher would come out and for a kick around at football at lunchtime, and he would name two kids to be team captains, and they'd pick their team. And I was invariably always either last or second last to be picked. And, like, when that is over a period of time, then that stays with you and that has an effect on you.
I hear you there 100%. Yeah, I hear 100% the last person to be picked.
And teachers and kids, they wouldn't realise, like, the effect. I mean, most kids would just shrug that off and it wouldn't. But, you know, it does have an effect on some kids who are sensitive. And
you see, it's the job of the teachers, isn't it, to make those students the captains of the team, so they get to make the choices.
I mean, sensitivity is great for writing. It kind of puts you in tune with people, with people's emotions, but on the downside, it also makes you vulnerable. So,
and vulnerable, you know, is good in writing, isn't it? No tears in the writer, tears in the reader.
Yeah, but it's difficult. You know, if you live your life like that, it's a bit difficult. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
But I mean, my writing started off from nothing. I mean, when I wrote my first one-act play, when that was staged, there was nothing in the cupboard after that. I mean, everything that has happened since, you know, I take credit for myself for pushing my work. And, you know, when there was no internet, when there were no emails, it was just hard slog.
Get out to the drama groups and...
Yeah, ringing around the country, cold calling secretaries of drama groups and saying, I have a play, would you like to read it? And then getting it photocopied and sending off this huge big package. And then you wouldn't expect to get it back. And, you know, there was a lot, there was an outlay at the start, obviously. But, I mean, it's paid off because the more plays you have being staged, the more, you know, the more people see your work. And seeing a play performed is much better than just reading a script.
And that is Jimmy Keary, Rathowen-based playwright. And you have surely seen his work all around the Midlands. And as the theatres open up again and as drama groups take on plays for the new season in September, October, November, you can be sure there will be more Jimmy Keary plays to be seen. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be staying in Westmeath, but crossing over the road to Athlone to hear from poet Paul McCarrick. You're very welcome back to Encore this evening. My next guest, my final guest on the show tonight, is Paul McCarrick, well known in Athlone. He was the 2021 John Broderick Writer in Residence Mentee, and he's also been one of the Poetry Ireland Introductions mentees, I suppose, as well as the best word for that. He joins me on the line. Paul, you're going to read a poem for us, A Field in Cool Father. Would you introduce it first, please?
Yeah, absolutely. This poem really is about my mother's father, my grandfather. My only memory is of this particular photograph, and it really kind of focuses on my feelings towards him and what he represents just in this static picture, even having never met him before in my life.
A Field in Culfather. There is a photo that I love to look at of a man I never met, my grandfather. It's like a Polaroid. That white square border frames him as he looks at or loads his gun. He is centred, balanced between the stony ground and the sky. A true rural blue of 1972, there or thereabouts, I am told. He has seen many days of work. You see it in his skin, the way he holds himself, even in how he is standing with his dog beside his feet, ready for herding or something else. Probably called Shep or Dottie, one of the names Mam guessed and couldn't remember. When she looks at it herself, she shakes her head and smiles, says he was a great man. She doesn't know who took the picture, what day, month, year. She knows that he was a great man, but instead of going any further, it's put away, and I think of him for the night, centred, balanced, between the land and the sky.
It must be challenging to write about somebody that you have never met or never seen, but who still is an important part of who you are.
It definitely is. It's very much came organically, though, which is surprising. It was never a thing that I kind of went out of my way to do. But as soon as I saw this particular picture with in let's say in the collection of photographs we have at home, it instantly struck me. He was just such a strong, seemed like such a strong personality, really definite in everything he did in this like single static photograph. And
lots of people have had quiet times in lockdown and over the last 2 or 3 years, but you have been very productive and lots of really good opportunities, I suppose, not with the Poetry Ireland Introduction series just before lockdown in 2019, and you were reading at Aiksha. You had all kinds of things going on. How productive have you really been, or does it just look really good on the outside?
I think there's definitely kind of a filament of prestige or progress with those kind of things. I mean, in truth, poetry, the introduction series with Poetry Ireland in 2019 was massive, and it was a real privilege to work with the poets in there. Some names that just roll off the tongue: Jim McElroy, Audrey Malloy, Emily Cooper as well. You know, there's some really great characters, and I mean, I'd really, really, really big success, I suppose, getting mentored by Keith Payne as part of the John Broderick,
yeah. Tell us about what that involved and what you learned from working with Keith.
I suppose Keith was a really, really good character to bounce off. And of course, this was all during lockdown, so we only had a Zoom screen between us. So that I thought was really going to prove to be a challenge, considering the work we had in front of us. Keith had a conversation with me at the start of the mentorship, and he kind of gave me a lot of options. He said, we can do a poem a week, or we can work on technique, or we can do whatever. And I've been building up a manuscript for quite a while of poems. And I said, will we go through this, Keith, and see what works and what doesn't, and what we can reshape and refashion? And he said, absolutely. So for 10 weeks, we worked through it. We went poem by poem, page by page. And as much as I'd love to have gotten to meet him in person over those 10 weeks, I think we really, really had a great connection over the you know, now infamous Zoom technology community. He really, really gave so much good guidance, criticism and encouragement.
And did the two of you collude over the murdering of darlings?
there was a lot of murdering of darlings, let's say that. But it was everything Keith brought forward was justified, and he put me onto some, I suppose, some great poets to look at, and we really kind of bonded over Kieran Carson.
Oh yeah,
and Derek Mahon, actually, who I hadn't thought about too much.
I'm a huge Derek Mahon fan.
Days, but,
yeah, he's an astounding writer.
Absolutely,
yeah,
so good, and it was great to just come back to it with a fresh light and with a fresh eye, going at it for a first kind of a pleasurable experience, and then a technique. What's he doing? What are they writing here? How are they giving you this emotion? It was really, really so good.
You mentioned the Leaving Cert now, so it's your fault. But what is it what experience did you have or not have in your reading of poetry or experience of poetry in school that has led you down the career path that you're on now?
We were really, really blessed with the teachers in Aloysius College. Patricia Cullen was our English teacher, and I think we were her final, let's say, first to sixth year group, full cycle, let's say. And she was incredible at just presenting poetry as a legitimate way of reading, because, you know, you look at novels and you go, right, that's a big story, so there's a beginning and an end, or you look at a film and, you know, everything is just so synonymous or ubiquitous that, you know, you read a book, you watch a film. She was always telling us to hang on to your anthologies, because people will normally not buy anthologies as they get older, you know. Hang on to that, because that poetry will be there forever. And truth be told, I still have my anthology, which is sitting proudly on my shelf.
Very important.
It really was just a pleasant experience with her. She particularly Derek Mahon, particularly Eva Boland, and particularly Adrian Rich. One day she sat us down and went through Diving Into the Wreck. And it's incredible to think she managed to get a room full of, 17 and 18 year old lads to pay attention to something like the feminist, icon that Rich is. But
yeah,
when she spoke, we all listened.
that is a wonderful credit to her that you think so highly of the work that she did with you. You have a second poem. Would you like to introduce it for us?
Absolutely, yeah. So this poem is probably, it's as much as Kilfada, Fianna Kilfada was based in South West Scotland, this is definitely situated on the River Shannon, walking across the bridge, in fact, and it takes a leaf out of maybe Frank O'Hara on a darker day, and it's called Shannon Diving.
Shannon Diving. Without fail or exception, during these heat waves, whenever you cross the bridge over the Shannon, all you want to do is drop fully into the slow grey sluice, like it's some conversation being had at a wake right over the body, safely serving and reserving the same memories again and again. And as the sweat threads down your forehead, out come the thoughts making you want to drop into it like it's one long awkward silence of you staring at people in a queue who had names just weeks before but now might as well be called Raging Smile, Patrick Sarsfield, Liam Gallagher. But get past that. Say, this is heat, isn't it? Want to leave? Think the river is here, why not drop down into it like February rain that turns to true storm hailstones people run away from, finding shelter all from the desire to be dry, and after a panicked minute, a scene hammered out of serene cold snow. But there's nothing but dry here, dry as far as the eye can see. How do you not want to be dropping into the Shannon like you are dropping from above? Direct and straight as a metric stick, diving through the stratosphere and the clouds into the looking eye of a citizen, just like a bomb, aiming for the black of the pupil. But even when it impacts, you feel the shockwaves. You stand still. You remember you're still standing on the bridge, smiling at yourself, sweating, thinking of suggesting, why don't we all drop in together, hand in hand to start with, squeezing before stepping, then dropping. Wouldn't that be something?
A diving into the wreck and Shannon diving. Is there a theme here, Paul?
There might be a subconscious thing going on. Because admittedly, anyone who knows me, I have a little bit of a fear of water, but water keeps on creeping into my poems, so I don't know what that says about myself.
Well, it says that you were reared in Athlone and you woke up in the middle of the night with water creeping all over the place.
that is very, very much the case. All right,
it's hard to get away from that.
It's very much a part of the identity, and you think of Athlone, and I think of straight off the castle, the river. And it's something that just links back to, you know, that medieval time of towns kind of forming on these banks of the rivers, because these are the modes of transport that people used, and this was the best way to kind of get about and whatever else. It's something I've moved recently away from Athlone, and there isn't a lick of water in sight in Kildare town. So I'm a little bit lost, I suppose. Maybe the water is my compass in some ways.
Well, you've moved from the deep water to the short grass. Tell me, you were working on a poem on a collection you had some help from Keith Payne in looking at those poems. Can we expect finally to see a collection from you or a selection in the near future?
I think we'll definitely be seeing a selection. There's nothing definite nailed down as yet, but I'm really working towards, let's say, a pamphlet or a shorter collection of I think poems that could really work well, really work with a locale, people and places, which is nearly effectively what a lot of poetry focuses on. But I think it's that old. The uniqueness is universal, and kind of bringing these characters to life, kind of in around the Midlands, in around Galway City as well. These people and places that, hopefully this selection will will be sooner rather than later. Let's say it like that.
Paul McCarrick, thank you so much for talking to us this evening on Encore.
Thanks very much, Karen. Much appreciated.
And that is it from Encore for this evening. Thank you very much for the pleasure of your company. And thanks indeed to all of my guests tonight. I'll be back in the seat again next week. And until then, you have the pleasure of the company of the cast and crew of Country Roads, which brings you the best of Irish and American country music after the news at 8 o'clock. Till we're talking again, take care of yourself. Good night.